The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The TV drama ER lasted 15 years, ending its run nearly a decade ago. But our fascination with the life and death critical situations that it brought to our attention will likely live on forever. My guest today has written a new memoir of real-life stories from 50 years in the emergency room, or as it's now called, the emergency department. Paul Seward attended Stanford and then medical school at Harvard University before deciding to train in pediatrics. Along the time he came out of residency, a trend toward full-time ER doctors was growing, eventually becoming a separately accredited medical specialty, which he was at the forefront of. His new memoir, Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room, began as an essay he wrote for a nonfiction writing class, and he developed the confidence to tell more stories and shop them around to agents and publishers. The result is a harrowing look at the perpetual discomfort one can have being in charge of a real-world emergency department, chock full of tragedy and occasional triumphs that Seward saw. Paul Seward, author of Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Paul Seward, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by talking about your career as an emergency medicine physician. You originally trained in pediatrics, but kind of segued over to emergency medicine at the very beginnings of it as a specialty. People, I think, the lay public don't often know and think, I mean, we have this sense that emergency medicine has been around forever. Tell us about your career development and how that happened.
I started out wanting to be a pediatrician. And while I was in training, I had some significant experiences with intensive care and things like that in the newborn nursery. But also, then I went out and joined a practice and was going to be a pediatrician. But at that time, the way emergency rooms worked, where there was a hospital, you know, hospital emergency room, a nurse sat there, somebody came in, she did an evaluation, called whichever doctor happened to be on call, which could be the ophthalmologist or whatever. That person came in and said, maybe you need a general surgeon, called the general surgeon, and it was basically not very well oriented to actual their needs of care, but nobody really got it that you really needed to do important things for care. Then in the 60s and 70s, as both hospitals got worried about it, they began saying, we got to do something better. And the solution was to put full-time doctors in the ER who hopefully knew something about emergency medicine, but there was the doctor in the ER, and he was going to be there, and he's going to see the patient get it done. And I started doing that as a moonlighting venture. You know, I ain't got nothing to do on my nights on call. I'm often in the hospital anyway. Why don't I work the ER? And I liked it. And one day I closed my practice and became a full-time ER doc and actually the director of the ER, because who knew how to do that then? And then they had established boards and residencies and things like that, and you can just take boards. In those days, you didn't have to have a residency, so I took boards, and the rest is history. And what basically happened is way too complicated to do everything. But emergency medicine became a specialty because it became academic. It developed. We've developed techniques and, you know, intubation techniques, you know, ultrasound of the abdomen, the whole ACLS, ATLS, PALS phenomenon for how do you resuscitate people and various degrees, and it became a righteous profession that was recognized as one basically by the end of the 80s.
One thing it always makes me wonder, though, is like you trained as a pediatrician, so you wind up, you know, directing emergency departments. How did you get comfortable taking care of adults, or was it just something you did through experience and it would be different
well,
nowadays?
Oddly enough, the first 3 years I was in a small hospital in Northern California, and I was the only full-time ER guy there, and I was also the director. And so when somebody came in, I would say, holy moly, you need a surgeon. So I'd call the surgeon, and meanwhile, I'd be starting the IVs and doing all that stuff. He'd come in, and we would take care of him. Sometimes I'd go to the OR with him if we weren't busy. And I learned a whole bunch of surgery from the surgeons. And then the orthopedist would have a guy come in, and I'd call the fracture, and I'd call them. And they taught me everything about orthopedics. And then the cardiologist taught me cardiology and intensive care. I had the best residency in emergency medicine you could possibly have, because I had a lot of smart docs there who couldn't teach anybody but me, and so they got to do it.
It really is a great residency. I mean, talk about like really learning by doing, an apprenticeship. I mean, just
absolutely. That's the way medicine has always been taught effectively. Yes, medicine does have an important core set of sciences and technologies, et cetera, but you know as well as I that you start learning medicine after you stuffed your head full of that stuff, most of which you will forget, and then you walk into a room and say, "Hi, I'm Dr. Seward." I always say, "I'm Paul Seward. I'm the doctor. What can I do for you?" That's when you learn medicine.
So I'm wondering if last thing to perseverate on here with the pediatrics is when you had young patients, you know, under 18 or even infants or toddlers, was that always somehow more comfortable for you to just go, "Oh, this is my wheelhouse. I'm very good with taking care of kids. I know how to do this." Or by that point, you had so much experience, didn't matter what the age of the patient was, you could take all comers.
You keep using this word that I don't understand. It's called comfort. Comfort with a sick patient. The goal isn't, I never thought my goal was to be comfortable. My goal was to be appropriately nervous at all times. Not so much that it kept me from being effective. But I always felt the moment you said, "Oh, here comes another one of these, appendicitis or whatever," is the day that you will miss something bad. But I was much more comfortable and always have been more comfortable with sick kids. I took care of sick kids a lot. But at the same time, if they were sick, I stayed nervous.
Well, I like your phraseology of appropriately nervous, because I think that's probably what we all want in our doctor, is, you know, somebody who's not taking something for granted. Although, you know, we like the idea that someone is comfortable having seen it before, but not unwilling to think things anew and think freshly. And so in your book, Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room, I wanted to start with something that's kind of basic towards the middle. You titled the chapter "Now and Then It's Fun." And this is something that I think is medical students get taught and doctors sort of love the idea. But I guess any parent who's had a small child who's had this will certainly know about it. But it's not something I ever had really encountered, so I did learn about it. But that's nursemaid's elbow. What is nursemaid's elbow? And I mean, is there ever anything more satisfying than that? A simple, discrete problem that can fix right away.
As I say in the chapter, nursemaid's elbow is really pretty quite common. And it's basically what happens when you try to pick up a kid who's heavy enough to weigh something, but not so heavy you can't pick him up with one hand with his arm outstretched. And one of the arm bones just pulls out and captures this little piece of tissue, and then it's a little out of place. And it shows up as a snapping noise, a child screaming, and then his arm hanging down, and he won't let you use it. And that's totally scary, especially because parents will instantly assume that they themselves did something wrong and that they broke their child's arm. But when you've seen it, and as I point out, if you see a little kid coming in with, "I think I broke his arm," and they give you that history, and the kid's standing there, and he's not bothered by much of anything, and his arm is hanging down straight, that's a big one. Because if you've got a broken elbow, if you've got blood in the joint, your arm is at 90 degrees because that's the position where the pressure is the least. But then the thing is, the maneuver to put the bone, it's not really out of place, to get that little piece of, you know, ligament out of the way is a one-second maneuver. And it's done. And you feel a little pop, and so you know you're done. And then 30 seconds later, the child's going to be bending his elbow. And so, you know, it made me feel like the faith healer on the top of the stage who's hitting the guy on the forehead, and "I've cured your cancer," you know. There's not many things where you can take a scared parent, a frightened and uncomfortable child, and do an assessment so you really know what you're doing, and then cure him.
Yeah.
Just like that.
I was very envious because there's nothing, there's very few things like that in adult medicine where it's just kind of something so cut and dry like that. You're listening to Medical Monday. It's Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Paul Seward, who is a retired emergency room physician and pediatrician, and he's just written a new memoir, his first. It's called Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room. And Paul, I was intrigued that you called it Death and Life. I think the usual sort of cliched title is more often, or subtitle, Life and Death. And I wonder if that's because there's a preponderance of sort of sad stories in here, and there are many, and you've seen them. But one I wanted to focus on actually was one that was pretty miraculous. And this is something I think that's very attractive to all of us as readers and as people. And that is the stories of where you don't expect someone to survive, and they do. And this is about a kid, I think, who had drowned and was underwater for something like 15 minutes. Can you tell us about that story?
Under warm water. Basically, it was... And I give away where it was at University Hospital in Augusta, Georgia. And for years I had the run sheet, so I really knew that time. The paramedics, there's canals around Augusta, and he basically went under and didn't come up. They called 911. The paramedics got there, and went in and fished them out. And basically, they have the time of the call and the time they fished them out, and that was 15 minutes. And I believe it was 15 minutes because when he came in, he was making a real good imitation of being dead. He had no heartbeat. Not just he didn't have pulse. He had a flatline EKG. He was utterly unresponsive. His pupils were fixed, and he wasn't doing anything. And you jump on these kids because you want to give them any chance you have. You don't really know how long they've been under your subject. So you resuscitate them. But somewhere along the first 20 minutes, you realize that this is all over. And every other time, somewhere around 15 or 20 minutes into the resuscitation, we look at each other and say, this is going nowhere, and we stop and have conversations with the family, et cetera. But right at the time we were going to stop, he had a heartbeat. You know, just a little bloop, didn't have another one for 30 seconds, and there was no pulse associated with it. And so that means that we were making progress. And so we kept on, and he got a heart rate, and he got a heart rate, and finally he got a pulse, and finally got a blood pressure over another 20 minutes. And then we were saying, oh, my goodness, you know, the heart's back, but the brain can't possibly be back. You know, the brain's been... And we knew the brain had to have been, his brain had to have been without oxygen because of the way he came in. A child doesn't become so hypoxic, that's no oxygen, that his heart just stops with no compressions. That takes a while. That is consistent with being under for that length of time. But that's a length of time that should fry his brain. And we know that it did fry his brain to some extent because he started seizing. And he had like 3-4 seizures in the ER. And, you know, we gave him anesthesia medication. Then he went upstairs and I went home. And I came back in the morning and I went up to the room he had been admitted to and he wasn't there. And I thought, oh my God, I guess he died during the night. And they said, no, he woke up, he ate dinner, had nothing wrong with his lungs, he ran and played. And so we sent him home. And I said, you must be kidding. Didn't believe it really. And then about a week later, one of the other doctors there said, remember that kid you had, the drowner who got well? I said, he just came in. Again, he was climbing a fence with his friends and cut his hand. He had a big laceration. I sewed him up. He was fine. I don't know what to do with that, except say, you know, it's nice that once in a career something like that happens.
Well, that was my next question. So it was once in a career. So miracles like that are pretty few and far between.
Yes.
And perhaps, unfortunately, more frequently are the stories you juxtapose alongside of that. Like there was a child who drowned. And there wasn't a happy ending. And in fact, you talk about how in the same sort of algorithm of a code of trying to bring the child back to life or to regain a heartbeat, the father who brought her in is in such shock himself that he has a difficult time sort of accepting the reality. And then it takes the mom coming in to sort of accept what's really going on. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yes. This is about the fact that certainly in pediatrics, you always have more than one patient. Your patient is the child, but the patient is also the parents. Maybe there's the family. But I would argue that really in any time you have a serious family tragedy going on, you have more than one patient. And the point is, if you can't save the official patient, the one who's drowning or the one who's dying of this or that, you can certainly make an enormous difference in the lives of the secondary patients, the family, et cetera. In this guy's case, what we did was he didn't want us to stop because he could see the ghost of his daughter in the corner of the room, as it were. But we were going to have to stop, but I figured, let's go get the mom. And they continued to do CPR the whole time. And that went on for, I think, about 20 minutes or half an hour while the police found the mom. The mom came in, and the mom was able to go over, recognize that she was dead, and tell the father that it was time to stop. And I don't know if that made much difference, giving him that time so that he didn't have it, because he was the one who was present when she drowned. He was the one who was watching her when she drowned. So he's got a mountain of guilt to work through. And so he couldn't say stop. You know, that would be killing his daughter twice. And I don't get me wrong, I don't mean they killed his daughter. Then in his own eyes, that's how it was seen. Drowning is so instant. You know, you go inside to answer the doorbell, and the happy child that was playing by the pool is on the bottom of the pool, dead. In the amount of time it took you to go answer the doorbell, I've seen that more times than I can imagine.
Say a little bit more about that in terms of treating the secondary patient. So is it, it's really just an opportunity, if you will, to let, I mean, even in a dire, horrible situation, to, in a way, provide some comfort to the parents?
I hope so. It wasn't, that was one where it was really hard. All that we could really do is not require the father to stop the code or be involved at all in that decision, have the mother do it. You know, it would be wonderful if he could get into some kind of a counseling situation, and obviously I'm sure and hope that he did, but that's a hard one. Where I think it also is important is, I think there's another story about a young woman who died of meningococcal septicemia in about 24 hours. And there, that's a situation where the mother had been taking care of her. She had a little sore throat, no big deal. And then suddenly she comes in and she's getting confused, has a horrible rash, and she rushes her to the hospital. But she's been homesick all day. And then, and in fact, she did die that early the next morning. But it was very important to me that the mother knew that her child's death was not her fault. Because there's no way to recognize that. How many kids have sore throats? How many kids have a low-grade temperature? Go, and, you know, I'm fine, Mom. I'm going to sleep it off. And who suddenly have meningococcal septicemia, which is, as you know, a catastrophic, awful disease. We gave all the antibiotics, but the trouble is you give the antibiotics and you kill the germ, but you've already all of the cascading, you know, clotting disorder things that are going to kill her are already, you know, doing it. But that was a situation where people could have been casting guilt on one another for the rest of their lives. And I don't know if I stopped it. I don't know if I could stop it. But that, to me, was the most important thing I could do, was to say, no, this is not your fault.
You mentioned in the case of the miracle child who survived the drowning that you went up to the ICU to check on the status of the kid who had actually miraculously woken up, eaten a meal, and gone home. How many times did you do that? I mean, on a given probably 12-hour shift or something, you probably saw, you know, a couple dozen patients, maybe more, many of whom come in for fairly mundane things that you're not going to follow up on. But some of those patients are sick enough to get admitted to hospital. Mm-hmm. And then you may just have an intellectual curiosity or a kindred spirit type of a thing where you want to follow up and see how they're doing. Does that happen kind of to you? Did that happen to you?
I didn't. All. By no means did I always go up to see patients, because you're right. You know, 80% of the patients who come to an ER are not admitted. And the ones that are may just sort of need an admission, get you upstairs, et cetera. And, you know, it's not every day that, you know, you have the ER TV show, you know, kind of thing going on.
Right.
But it happens often enough so that, you know, I go downstairs and, you know, hey, what happened to the guy in a big bad motor vehicle accident last night? Oh, this one died and that one's upstairs, et cetera. And I find out what's going on, and that might be enough. But this kid was, the question I had was, did I create a neurological disaster by resuscitating him? Because by everything I knew, he was a miracle. He wasn't my miracle. He was a nursing miracle. He was a respiratory therapy miracle. He was my colleague Dick Eckert's miracle. Everybody did everything. And he was the paramedics' miracle. Most of all, they started doing good CPR in the field and brought in a kid that they were already must have been doing some perfusion. That was a multiple-person, you know, I was sort of the guy standing around trying to figure out what to do next. But I was worried that he had become a neurological catastrophe. And I've seen what that can do to people's lives. And I just wanted to find out what had happened. And absolutely, I went upstairs.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Paul Seward, a retired emergency room physician and pediatrician who has just written a beautiful memoir called Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room. And Paul, this is your first book. Tell us a little bit about your writing craft. Did you keep journals throughout your, it says on the jacket, 50 years?
I've written all my life, but not, you know, 25 years ago I wrote a novel, trotted it out, no luck. About 10 years ago, I rewrote it, trotted it out, no luck. You know, between the time I was in college and the time I met my wife, I had a fair number of reasons to be unhappy about members of the opposite sex, and I wrote a bunch of really bad poetry then that I still have in the bottom drawer, which I stopped having to do.
Maybe someday in your accumulated papers.
They're there. I've written a number of professional things. I've written two philosophical articles that I wound up getting published on the philosophy of mind, which is interesting to me. But I've written lots of letters. I've written all my life. Writing has been a solace, but it's never been for publication, really. I just kept writing. But what really happened was after the book bombed, my novel couldn't get sold, and I was living in New Hampshire, I said, I think I'm going to take a writing class and see what happens. And the fiction writing class was full, so I took the nonfiction class.
You're kidding. So getting into nonfiction was really more of an accident?
Pretty much.
Huh, that's fascinating.
But and then what happened is my wife had been reading the my novel. She said, yeah, oh, that's not bad. Yawn, not bad. Not bad, okay. And then I wrote a couple of chapters of the book. She said, Paul, this is good. You should do this. Don't do that. Do this. So I did. And it turned out to be very fulfilling and fun, and I hope people like it.
So what was the class? You said it was on nonfiction writing, and I guess what built your confidence to the level that you shopped this around to agents or editors or publishing houses?
Oh, when I finished the book?
Yeah.
The second story in it was actually a story that I wrote for the class. And by the way, this was a Southern New Hampshire University, you know, online teaching. I've never met my teacher in person, but I certainly talked to her on the computer and stuff like that. But
oh, wow.
And she said, "This is, you know," she encouraged me. She said, "Hey, Paul, you can do this. You can write this stuff. You know, you should do that." And so I said, "Okay." And then I wrote it, and then yes, I shopped it around, and it felt a lot like my book. At first, I went through 25 query letters and. Before I ran into this wonderful person at Harvey Clare, who said, "Hey, you know, Paul, I think we can do something about this, and I'd like to represent you."
Very nice.
And I said, "What?" And not only that, she helped me smooth it out a little bit, and then she sold it to Catapult,
and here we are.
There it is. Yeah.
And
for anybody who's thinking of doing this, the advice is this. You can't write in hopes of getting published, because if you write really hard and work really hard and you're really pretty good and you got a good thing, the odds are still against you, because there's, you know, everybody's got a book, and the agents have to sit and pick through this stuff, and it's kind of like, I sort of feel it's like winning the publisher's clearinghouse thing, you know? Oh, somebody said yes. I got lucky. But you have to be good and you have to work hard. And you have to write a lot of query letters, and you have to be prepared for a ton of rejection. And most of all, you have to say, well, that's okay, because I have a lot of fun writing, and God, my college roommate read it, and he really liked it, and that was fun. He got it. And you have to write because you want to write.
So let's talk a little bit about that chapter. It was a short story, or really a storytelling of, it's called Shears, is it not? Is that the one?
That's
that was,
correct.
Yeah,
that's
that was
correct.
Kind of an amazing story in and of itself, too. You'd probably only see in an emergency room. What happened there, and why was that so unusual?
Well, first of all, you have to remember that took place in 1966, okay, just a little while ago. And that was in the old Boston City Hospital. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
My wife did her residency there, so
Boston
yes.
City Hospital.
Yeah.
Now it's a nice, beautiful, you know, concrete and steel. Then it was brick. You know, the air conditioners were in the windows, things like that. But this guy had some dispute with somebody, and the guy stabbed him in the back of the neck with some pruning shears. And they'd gone pretty far in. And he walked into the ER, and the ER sent him upstairs, and they said, "Hey, you guys," because medical student's job is to go and look and gawk, and become more familiar with what it is that happens. And these shears, and they were exactly in the back of his neck. He was completely neurologically intact. But the problem is that no one wanted to pull it out, because if you pull it out and release all the bleeders that you've cut, you're going to have a giant hematoma in the spinal cord, and that's going to kill him. But as I point out, we're all bilaterally symmetrical, and therefore it turns out to be the blood vessels on one side go to one side, and the others go to the other, and you can get right in the middle and miss most, not all, of the blood vessels, and that's basically what he evidently did. And I've never seen any, well, the other story about the guy had been shot and the bullet was in the middle of his head was sort of like that, but he wasn't quite as lucky.
Yeah, and so in the end, those shears just came right out, huh?
He just pulled them out. And the guy was fine. He wiggled his toes. The guy stitched him up, and they sent him downstairs. Now, if the next day they found him stiff as a post in bed, nobody ever told me, but there seemed to be no reason why he wasn't just fine.
Now, contrast that with, as you pointed out, the other story where there was this patient who came into the ER who thought maybe he had some blood coming from the back of his head, and you thought initially, before you had some imaging done, that maybe a BB or something had pierced his scalp or something. There's some blood, but nothing too serious.
Well,
no exit.
What happened was he'd been in a bar, and there's been something going on, and then he heard a noise, and he felt a whap right in the back of his head, right, you know, where that little bump on the back of your head is. And so he said, God, I wonder if I've been shot, because he felt back there, and there's a little blood, and there's a little bump and stuff like that. And so they take him into the ER. He actually drove himself to the ER. Or he got there on his own and sort of walked in and says, I think I've been shot in the head. The nurse looks up and says, maybe you have, and put him in a room fairly quickly. And I looked at him. And when I palpated his head, I could feel kind of a raised object about an inch or so above above where the hole was. So I said, I bet what happened is it was a .22 or something like that, and it went through the skin. But if it hit the skull obliquely, it would have tunneled up a little way, maybe, and just is now sitting under your scalp. And so let's get an X-ray. Well, that isn't what happened. It had gone straight into his head, and it was a low-velocity bullet, a .22 of some kind. So it didn't go all the way through his head. It went right about to the middle. But again, the brain is a bilaterally symmetrical, you know, the middle of the brain is a pretty small place, and I think he was just above the corpus callosum, and so he hadn't hit anything. Corpus callosum, for the readers, is sort of big connections between the two halves of the brain, so they can talk to each other. But he certainly created a great big inflammatory process that was already working to kill him, and that's what the neurosurgeon said. Even if he took the bullet out, he wouldn't be able to save his life.
Right, and it was just so disheartening because here you thought, wow, this guy had narrowly escaped a sure death or chronic paralysis or something, and then the imaging showed you that, again, it was like this bullet had landed right in the midline, and so nothing neurologically was going on while he was there. In fact, drove himself to the ER, and yet there was really nothing that could be done to save him. It was just so disheartening.
And what started when he finally declined, it wasn't because he came paralyzed on one side or another thing like that. He just went to sleep because his brain was swelling.
Well, if you enjoy a little bit of gore, but some really meaningful stories from a 50-year career in emergency medicine, you'll enjoy the memoir written by my guest today. It's called Patient Care, Death and Life in the Emergency Room, and it's a memoir by Paul Seward, who is a now retired emergency room physician and pediatrician. And Paul Seward, thank you so much for joining us.
It has been a privilege. Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our shows, stream them online anytime on a smartphone, tablet, or computer. Just go to our website, studiotulsa.org. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.